sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Unemployment at 7.9%. The Dow is over 14,000. Geithner is out. Lou is in. And our guest today, Tim Seymour. You know him. All this and much more on episode number 299 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, how are you? This is Andrew Horowitz, and this is the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Hope you're tuning in because you're finding that the investment environment is all sorts of fun, all sorts of confusing, and sometimes a little bit frustrating. And that's what we're here to talk about a bit, to kind of give you some ideas and some things that you can use on a regular basis to enhance what you're doing in the world of investments. In fact, what we do is we bring guests aboard. We have a great one today, as I mentioned, Tim Seymour from Fast Money and Trigem Asset Management. We'll talk to him in a little while. And we're going to talk about some earnings things, what happened last week, where we are in the market cycle, et cetera. We have to start off with the fact that the Dow is over 14,000. Now, you knew on Friday, coming into the day, it seemed like, you know, they just wanted to push that Dow over 14,000. You get that headline splash, and that kind of makes investors a little bit more interested in getting involved, because now they're finding that, hey, you know what, maybe we're not going to have all these problems. You know, we had the fiscal cliff, we've had the Europe, we've had China, we've had all these issues that are coming into the fore, and the markets still continue to do better. And what does that tell me? Well, maybe it's time for me to get in. The fact is that we saw unemployment tick up to 7.9%, a little bit better on some of the labor conditions that we've been seeing lately, although the initial claims last week did spike to about 368, and that was kind of unexpected. But at the same time, really what the driver was, and even though the newspapers and the media said that it was the unemployment was better, that was not the driver of the move last Friday. Remember, Wednesday and Thursday, we saw a drop in the markets, nothing severe, but a little bit of a takeoff. And there was some question about some of the earnings, some of the economics. And really what was going on there was a anticipation of a questionable unemployment number on Friday. You know, with all of the things that happened back in December, we're kind of starting to see the first readings of how that played out in January and February. But what really, I think, was the biggest driver, what was the biggest surprise to me, in fact, was that we had the manufacturing number actually tick up much better than was expected. In fact, I've talked to you many times about how we're seeing the inventory numbers really weak, and that was a big sign that many of the manufacturing areas around the country, the regions, were going to probably be weak, and they were, and they have been. Now, it's interesting how that doesn't translate into the core, the ISM manufacturing number that we saw actually tick up on Friday. Now, whether or not we're going to see inventories continue to rise, we have some numbers coming out this week with wholesale inventories towards the end of the week, but it's a generally a light week of economics, and that's kind of good because we still have a lot of earnings to deal with. Many of the companies that put out earnings last week, it was interesting because it's kind of like what we're seeing with economics. We're seeing that companies are meeting or maybe even beating or close to earnings. Revenues are questionable, but their guidance is very light. They're very concerned about the outlook. Investors are taking that as, okay, you know what? You met last quarter. We're okay. We'll see what happens. So they push stocks up. They're finding excuses. Look at what happened with Amazon. Finding excuses to drive a stock higher. The fact is that Amazon did turn around and move lower. As a matter of fact, on DH Unplugged this week, that was my pick for a short. And I think we're up about 5 or 6% on that short pick for DH Unplugged, that little game that we play. And you can track all that by going over to dhunplugged.com and click on the weekly spreadsheets tracking. But what's happening is there is a bit of euphoria out there, and the idea that earnings are coming out is an indication when we see that when earnings are just meeting, even on meeting the lowered expectations after the stock has already run up, and then the guidance is light, and the stock continues to move up after that, you have to wonder what's going on. The best stocks so far in this earnings season have been the stocks that have disappointed in the past but met or beat moving forward. It's like analysts are so far behind the curve here, it's ridiculous. We're seeing the same thing with economics. The economic analysts and the economists are really behind the eight ball here when it comes to predictions. They're trying to play the safe mode, you know, come out with what was and maybe a mix of what management says is going to be and try to get close. But their outlook is just, it's preposterous. I mean, I've looked at so many analyst, estimates, and it's almost like they're throwing darts. I mean, I don't see how there's any kind of really quality analysis that's going on. Maybe it's because of all the uncertainty out there. Maybe it's because companies have figured out how to manage, quote unquote, their overall earnings when they talk to analysts. I don't know exactly what's going on, but there's something a little fishy. It's almost like they're guessing, and there's no real pattern to how this is all playing out. And we know that analysts are generally considered penguins. You know, when one jumps in, the rest of them jump in. Nobody was downgrading Apple forever. And all of a sudden, downgrades started happening, and they all hopped on. And that's kind of what happens. They don't want to be too far off because their job is at risk. So what they do is they kind of stay with the consensus, and the consensus is a moving target, but generally it doesn't move very much when everybody's kind of like not wanting to make a move until after the fact. Rarely do you see an analyst upgrade or downgrade a stock into earnings. They just stay with what they have. Then after they know what happens, they downgrade or upgrade. So when you look at a stock like, for example, Align, which is something we've talked about before, the dental company, they do the Invisalign that was getting into the global business of braces, et cetera. When you see them last quarter disappointing dramatically, and then this quarter they start riding back up a little bit into earnings, and then earnings come out and they're up 10% on earnings. Great. Under Armour did great. But again, these are companies that were questionable in terms of, wow, they, you know, are they going to do well? And, you know, we've seen the last quarter's very weak, and let's kind of downgrade a little bit and kind of bring their stock price in terms of our estimates and our targets. And then what happens is when they meet or beat, because analysts have got too far to the negative side now because they missed a couple of quarters, so they just go with the trend, and the stock explodes, and vice versa. Now, this week, there's some important earnings, a lot of earnings coming out. Let me just kind of go through those very quickly and tell you what's happening. We have Yum Brands coming out. Now, that's an interesting stock because it's known as an indicator of the China markets. Now, last quarter, they had a real problem. Their numbers really were not very good. They saw a big slowdown in China, and they really telegraphed that quite apparently and outwardly in their earnings call. Now, this quarter, already we're seeing a lot of changes on EPS estimates, about down 20 or 30%, and the sales estimates down about 2% in the last 4 weeks. So already we're seeing that analysts are bringing down their estimates. And what that tells me a lot of times is that they're very pessimistic and often too pessimistic. Looking for about 82 cents on $4 billion of revenue for the quarter. They're coming out on the fourth after market. Now, an interesting one is going to be Acme Packet. Acme Packet, which makes the logic boards for voice over IP. And this is a company that I've always thought should be acquired by Cisco. I've always said that. But they're looking for about 8 cents on $68 million of revenue, and the analyst estimates are about flat. Now, that stock has risen from the last couple of quarters after they really disappointed investors. I mean, it was down to 15, 14, something like that, and it's in the 20s again. Now, we'll see what happens with that, but that's an interesting one to keep an eye on from the area of technology and from the area of, you know, what has happened with regards to the overall you know, what an analyst is expecting and what's happening with investors if they're running ahead of this and getting a little bit too optimistic. Hartford Financial will be out also on the 4th. TransDigm Digital Group on the 4th before the market, kind of important. We're going to see also The same day, we're going to see Estee Lauder. Now, what's interesting, actually, that's the next day. That's on the 5th. Estee Lauder is important because we're going to look at that from a consumer discretionary standpoint and from an area of women's purchases. Always an important thing to look at. We also have Kellogg coming out on the 5th. We'll see how the increased price or decreased price of grains are affecting them. Chipotle. Now, this is a stock that's been under pressure for a while. They said they weren't going to increase their menu prices very much. But then they, you know, kind of did a little bit here and there, and the food prices were a big concern. But since then, corn has come down dramatically. Meat prices generally have come down. They're looking at about $1.96 on about $700 million of revenue. Now, in the last 4 weeks, we've seen the stock ride up a bit. And in fact, the EPS has gone up from an estimate standpoint about 8%, but the revenue's down about 6%. So see how that plays. And that has been a stock that has been shorted and has been beaten down pretty well from their highs. Disney is going to be out on the 5th. We'll see after the recent price increases what happens there. Looking for 77 cents on about $11 billion of revenue. We'll see Panera Bread coming out the same day. Hain Celestial, H-A-I-N, has been a stock that has been said is going to have a real problem here. You know, they do the natural foods and all that. We'll see how that plays. One of my favorite companies, although it's very volatile, is Shutterfly. Now, if you haven't used Shutterfly, I don't know what you've been. Shutterfly is just a great photo printing service and sharing, I guess, and has a whole bunch of things in terms of making your cups and your mugs and your mouse pads and books, and very easy to deal with and very price efficient if you do any photography at all. Plus, they store your photos there forever. Great apps. Looking for $1.39 on about $300 million of revenue. And analysts have increased their earnings slightly. Expedia is coming out on the 5th also. That's going to be an interesting signal for the entire travel industry. Cummings, the truck company, on the 6th before market. And then we have a whole bunch of things. Interesting, Nu Skin will be there. Now, Nu Skin has been under attack, which with Herbalife and all the other multi-level marketers since Ackman came out with his whole big hoo-ha. Of course, we've had Einhorn out also and Icon. I guess you have to have a vowel as a your first initial to really be in or out of the stock, it seems. But we'll see what happens with that. It's going to be interesting because when you see Nu Skin, if they do come out with earnings, I would think that we're going to see a big short squeeze on that if they do beat and they have some good things to say. Green Mountain Coffee on the 6th, that's going to be a wild one. Last earnings was up, boy, man, that stock was up like 30% on the earnings. Looking for about 64 cents on about a $1.3 billion of revenue. Let's see, Visa also, MasterCard hit an all-time high last week. They're looking for about $1.79 and about $2.8 billion of revenue. Some smaller ones, Akamai, Yelp, are going to show up and have some extreme volatility as well on that day. And then let's see what else we got here. Philip Morris coming out on the 7th. And what else do we have here? Coinstar, always an interesting mover. Nuance Communications on the 7th. We'll see how that plays. That one's kind of looking a little bit interesting from a charting standpoint. And then finally, LinkedIn on the 7th. That should be interesting. The stock has risen up very nicely. And the stock has actually come back into the high zone where it's been. So this is going to be a very key earnings for them. Looking for 19 cents on $279 million of revenue. And Riverbed Technology will also be out. And then we're going to wrap it up. Let's see. OpenTable. There's a lot more than this, but I'm just giving the highlights of some of the more volatile and interesting stocks that will be playing next week. OpenTable. Looking for 44 cents on the 7th with only $42 million of revenue. So kind of that's going to give you the play for the week of what's happening with earnings. And I think those are important to really focus on. Watch what happens with earnings. You know, don't jump in right when the earnings come out, when you see the headline, because oftentimes it's during the conference call when you see the real guts of what's happening with the company in terms of their outlook. And then also you see what their guidance is going to be and how many of the analysts, what the questions are, how they question, you know, and what their kind of takeaway is and what they're really focusing on in that Q&A session during the conference call. That's really kind of the core of some of this. And when you listen to that, you get a really good understanding. And I will tell you that many of the conference calls that we've listened to, and especially during the Q&A, it's been a relatively pessimistic view from the outlook of many of the managers and managers of companies. And that is not usually the case. And that's kind of, I think, a bit interesting to kind of consider and then put that into the perspective of where markets are and then look at the economics, in particular, the ESI, economic surprise index that we just looked at this week. And we're seeing a big differential between the surprise index, which is what economists expect and what really happened, to the market. And there's usually a pretty reasonable correlation between the two, but the market's going up and that's going straight down. Hit a negative 30 last week for the U.S. So that being the case, there's all that to look at. Now, we're going to talk a little bit about a few other things. I want to talk about China's services. I want to tell you about the Trigger Point Research Commodity Alert, something very, very cool that I really want you to pay attention to. We're going to do that right after our guest. But there's a whole new way of doing things, and we've listened to you and how you want to do things and the speed of the transaction, alerts and signals, and I'll explain that in a minute. We'll get to our guest. But before we do, I want to mention GoToMyPC. And GoToMyPC is one of those great services that you can have, and you can have it for free. I'm about to tell you how. So all you have to do is simply go to GoToMyPC.com and click on the Try It Free button, and you get 30 days for free. But here's what you get. You get a secure remote access tool from Citrix that turns any computer, tablet, or smartphone into your office computer. Very simply, very easily. Because with GoToMyPC, you can basically access your entire network, use any program that you have. You can save, edit, send any file anywhere from anywhere. You don't have to carry a flash drive around anymore, and gives you the freedom to work wherever and wherever and you want. Whenever, wherever we want. So, simple to use, sets up in just minutes. Go check it out. Go to my PC, click the Try It Free button there, and enter the promo code podcast, and you get 30 days free. You can actually download it for your computer, for your mobile device. Go to mypc.com. Great service. And our guest today is Tim Seymour, and you know him from Fast Money, just a magnificent drummer. He's also the managing partner of Triagem Asset Management, which is a hedge fund that specializes in the emerging markets on a long short or a long only. He's also the founder of EmergingMoney.com, which is kind of the go-to place for everything about emerging markets. So, Tim, how are you?
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me. And if only, you know, we all know markets are about perception, and half of that is therefore reality. If only, you know, the reality of my drumming was as good as the perception. But this is the nice thing about actually being a guy that's on TV every once in a while, and they can get a stale clip of me playing drums, and suddenly I've become Keith Moon.
Yeah. Oh.
So.
Yeah.
Well, I love it.
Start kicking over. All you have to do is start kicking over
fact,
the drums.
I'd rather talk about my drumming than the market. But anyway, on we go.
All right, so listen, there's a lot of things happening around the world. Obviously, just a tremendous amount of cash is being pumped in from everybody. You know, we see what's happening with the yen, and I think there's a lot to do with what's happening with the euro. Kind of they're dumping, it makes sense to me at least, dump the yen, dump the dollar, buy the euro. Seems like an obvious move. But what's happening with the emerging markets? I mean, they're kind of a little bit lagging behind. We have some things happening in India, still an inflation problem. In emerging Asia, there's some unbelievable moves going on. You know, we saw that craziness in Vietnam, and then Philippines is at an all-time high. You got Brazil and Latin America are kind of like in between. So kind of what's the rotation here? What's going on?
Well, you know, what you pointed out is that I think there is definitely an environment where people are taking risk, and the yen is your barometer for that, both in terms of the classic sense of the carry trade and also that they are to now really pumping money into the system, and the misperception was that they were doing this all along. They really weren't. Emerging markets have had an interesting start to the year because the headline index has underperformed. And if you look at the MSCI EM or, you know, people that are tracking the ETFs like the EEM or the VWO, these have actually, they're down on the year. I mean, they're, you know, and yet you look at markets like definitely in frontier land, it's been extraordinary. Argentina's up 23%, Kazakhstan's up 11.5%, Vietnam's up 17%. But, you know, the most important market for emerging is China, and China has had a fantastic start to the year, too, and going all the way back to the lows on deck four, China's up 22% from that point. So you need China to rally the whole thing is always what I say, and I mean emerging, and you're getting it. But, you know, I think there's some cross currents here. There are currency issues in places like South Africa and arguably in Brazil, where you have in South Africa's case, you have the widely understood or at least chronicled labor unrest, the current account issues, and an economy that is struggling with, you know, even some of the export demand for some of its core commodities. In Brazil, you have a case where they manipulated the currency much, much weaker to make their economy more competitive. And now you actually have some real inflation problems in Brazil that aren't really talked about, but are out there. So to also just to kind of tie it all together, emerging markets this year will, I think, allow some of the underperformers to rally, and that is China, and that is Russia. And let's see about Brazil, because I do think Brazil's got some challenging macro, but that ultimately this is a market that has been the worst performer in the emerging world for 2 years and has some issues, despite the fact that this is probably the one market that I bet a lot of your listeners and people that are more casual about their EM focus have always thought was the greatest market in the EM world, and it really hasn't been.
You know, one of the things about Brazil, though, I mean, there's a variety of ways to invest in it. So as a hedge fund manager, you go in there and you find a variety of stocks that you like. But if you were to be a casual investor and you want to buy Brazil, you'd buy the ETF. The problem is that the Brazilian market, the stock market, is such a giant piece of Petrobras, right? It's enormous.
Yeah, and Vale.
Right. So the problem you have there
and
is...
Vale. So you're getting at a good point, which is that, you know, it's the whole index is skewed to the valuation of Petrobras, you know, and then the B shares, A's and B's, and then Vale. So you've got, therefore, an index which looks remarkably cheap because these companies are cheap on a valuation perspective, but, you know, that's definitely equal value trap. And the best performing parts of Brazil in the last 2 years have been far and away the retailers. That includes shopping malls, apparel, it includes then some of the food retailers, and so, you know, those have been the exciting parts. The parts that are related a little bit more to infrastructure build-out have not been as straight of a line, but there's been some fantastic, performers in there. The places that have been really tough are the places that have been the most, historically were the places people were the most overweight to. So not just Petrobras and Vale, but even take kind of phase two of people's interest in Brazil, and it was the banks. It was Itaú, it was Bradesco, it was, you know, Banco Santander Brazil. It was, and then it was the home builders. So it was Gafisa, it was PDG, it was, you know, these have been, in the case of the home builders, almost death trades. And in the case of the banks, they've been places where actually you've had margin contraction and a lot of pressure from the government. And I don't know that changes. In the case of the home builders, they may be actually undergoing a bit of a bounce here, and they may be oversold. And I actually think there may be a little bit more of a trade there. I think the banks are going to recover. But, you know, Brazil's not going to be easy in 2013.
Right. Well, the other problem is, and we'll kind of finish up on Brazil and Petrobras, but Petrobras is basically owned by the government. So, you know, you have them setting prices for the fuel. You know, they can kind of raise it, lower it, and, you know, at will. And, you know, it's not really a free market, you know, type of company. And if it's such a large component of the index, that's where I kind of get a little bit, you know, hazy on why would I invest in that, the index, that is.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure that you would. I think it's why people need to do a little bit more work when they break down, you know, the components of an ETF and see what's going on. Petrobras yesterday announced a price raise, something the market's been waiting for a long time. Except for the fact that they raised prices 6.6% when the market needed, you know, when people in the market were needing, you know, north of 15%, when the company probably needs at least north of 10% to make a difference. And the problem with that is that there's inflation in Brazil, and this is a political football too, where they're not going to raise prices as much as they should. Now, ultimately, Petrobras's credit rating may come under some pressure if they don't really get a place to see prices go higher, and that may be something that forces the government's hand, and that'll ultimately be very positive for them. But right now, I think Petrobras is somewhat dead money.
Right. So what about, you know, the whole, I know you also pay attention to the rest of the world, not just emerging markets, but one of the things I find really interesting is that when you look at valuations, and not just simple PE, just conceptually the idea that, you know, for the most part in the U.S. are, you know, we didn't have a big jump in net earnings. Revenues are kind of flat to questionable over the last quarters or so. But yet the prices of stocks are a lot more. So you kind of throw in, all right, well, you know, people are more, you know, sentiment has changed a little bit. But at the same time, we're seeing things like in the UK, a potential for a triple dip recession, but their markets keep going up. What's the fuel behind all this?
Well, I don't don't think markets are terribly expensive. I mean, if you look at equity markets globally, I mean, the S&P is trading at, you know, around, you know, 14.8 times earnings current. And I think, you know, on next year's numbers, it's you know, got a 13 handle. That's not expensive by historic standards. If you look at Europe, Europe's even cheaper, despite the run that Europe's had. So, yes, it's been you know, widely kind of expected that the fourth quarter earnings that were in the tail end of in the U.S. were going to be challenging. And you suddenly have 75% of the companies that have beaten. And you've got a greater percentage of beats this quarter than we've had since 2009 when expectations were terribly low. So I think expectations were overly pessimistic coming into this quarter. The world's not going to be clicking on all cylinders in the first half of 2013. And clearly we, you know, got a bit of a scare on U.S. GDP headline yesterday when you throw a negative print on the U.S. and the world's biggest economy. But that things are healing. And I think ultimately stock valuations reflect value for the most part.
Right.
And it's always going to be about tomorrow's earnings. But if you look at what's coming through, guidance has not been terrible. And if you're in a world where, at least for a big portion of the S&P, especially when you look at you know, some of your, how should we say? The inflationary pressures that is what I'm referring to that are not there is certainly very positive for a good portion of the S&P.
Right.
It's not good for materials and resource companies, and says that maybe, you know, this part of the investment cycle that's been for a lot of investors, you know, something that they started doing for the first time 5 or 6 years ago, and you know, were the last guy standing when the commodity bubble burst, but. No inflation, deflation is something the Fed's fighting every day, and it's something that ultimately is very good for certain parts of the economy. Let's not kid ourselves.
Yeah.
So deflation, bad thing,
right.
No question.
It's kind of fascinating.
Inflation and low inflation, very positive. And you have some Goldilocks stuff going on for a good part of the S&P.
You know, it's interesting, though, that don't you find it really fascinating how there's so much money being pumped into all these different countries and there's no inflation? I'm not suggesting there's any kind of conspiracy. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying the fact is, except for everything costs us a little bit more. I don't know about you, but there's no inflation. But nonetheless, it's kind of interesting how it almost looks like, if you can kind of step back, they're filling a hole. You know, this big void that was created by the market meltdown of in real estate and the banking issues and balance sheet adjustments and the you know, all the holes that were there. It's kind of like all this money is being dumped into a vat and has to kind of fill up before we can get the inflation part. And so far, it hasn't been there.
Well, you know, the credit bubble burst, which then turned into a sovereign bubble, has incredibly deflationary consequences to it and what the Fed is doing. And I think rightly so, even though we'd all like to see the economy attempt to stand on its own 2 feet. Has been fighting the deflationary forces that are out there, and everybody's read how Bernanke's been a student of the Depression and this and that. But you know, look at a few core industries. Look at the consumer electronics space.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, prices get cheaper every year. Look at the apparel and the clothing space. Prices get cheaper every year. Look at the service industries. Look at you know, productivity gains also have led to, just a deflationary environment, and that's positive. But you know, effectively, you've got an environment where people earn nothing on their money, and we're in a state essentially of financial oppression. This is what the global central banks have put us through.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying that some of this hasn't been required by the circumstances. But you know, we're in an environment where you have to try very hard to reinflate asset prices. It's one of the reasons why I think stocks can go higher, because
right.
They are focused on the stock market and they've left investors no other place to go. Possibly the real estate market, so we'll see about that. But you've got a macro setup here where you really don't have inflation for most of the things that at least are measurable inflation. You and I both know that if you're putting a kid through school, You've never paid more. We all know that if you're getting your electricity bill somehow, no matter, you know, despite the fact that the U.S. shale and coal production and all types of the things that should be supporting very cheap power production, not helping. My electric bill's as high as it's ever been.
Mm-hmm.
There are elements that you're just not seeing this trickle on through. But you know, ultimately, we are in an environment where gaining momentum back up in terms of asset prices is something that is a bit of a catch-22 when the Fed is pumping so much money in the world. That should be inflationary. It has not proven to be to this point. And yet, we need them to step away to actually allow prices to find a base. And that's going to be market negative. So if I had to tie it all together, I'd say I still think this is an environment where equities go higher.
Yeah. So what's your favorite country out there? I mean, we've kind of been through an interesting gyration of, you know, China kind of was in bad shape and then miraculously just seemed to come back, and India's got all sorts of issues, and then it comes, you know, kind of cleaned up a little bit. I think you liked Turkey at one time. We talked about that some time ago. You know, kind of where is like that, you know, if you were to say, hey, you know, this general area is really building, it's really looking strong, and it's the next place that could be really extremely beneficial to investors. What, do you have a particular country or sector or area, I should say?
Well, there's been incredible moves in places like Turkey, Mexico, South Africa. In fact, Turkey really has had a phenomenal run, and was probably the best performing market in the world from the bottom of markets in June through actually probably a couple of days ago. Turkey's had a pretty nasty pullback over the last couple of days, and I still like Turkey, and I think Turkey going investment grade is something that will happen, not as soon as people were expecting. But and you know, South Africa and Mexico, which were also last year's darling markets, those were three of the top five performing markets in the world, anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the dynamics supporting that are things that you can take as you know, messages into 2013, which is that these are heavy consumer economies. These are places where there's significant production. These are places advances. These are places where you're seeing a number of interesting factors in terms of their productivity growth, but more importantly, you're seeing per capita income. I think Russia's going to do very well in 2013, unless, you know, the big caveat to that is that your, you know, oil needs to hold kind of, you know, 105 to 110 on Brent, and I think it will. But Russia, in terms of valuation, is extremely cheap, has been a laggard, is a, you know, I think a misunderstood market in terms of there's actually a very strong consumer story to play in Russia. I'm not going to try to tell you that the Russian demographic story is a phenomenal one, but it's actually not as bad as people think. So I think Russia's underperformed and will outperform in 2013. I actually think Brazil is going to outperform in 2013 from this point on. So, year to date, Brazil's down small, and a lot of emerging is up quite a lot. I think you're going to see the currency find a base. The central bank is really had no place but to weaken the currency to make the economy more competitive. I think the economy is more competitive, and again, if anything, I think the currency needs to strengthen a bit to ward off some of the inflationary forces that are out there. So, complicated and difficult in Brazil because you have politics that are still, I think, favoring, you know, social support systems, etc. But you've got a World Cup, you've got an Olympics coming up in the next, you know, 2014, 2016, and you've got a place where there's a lot of build-out that needs to go. The banks have priced in an extraordinary amount of margin contraction, I believe, and I think there's still a lot of room to run in the Brazilian consumer story. So, you know, we like Brazil. I think the Middle East is going to be an interesting place to invest. I think Egypt, if they can get this IMF loan, and if they can, you know, obviously, you know, the main driver for valuations in Egypt has been, you know, political stability or the lack thereof, and so that's going to be your bogey. And, you know, frontier markets in general have been doing very well. The Middle East has lagged. And, you know, I think you've got a shot actually to see Egypt and Saudi Arabia have big years.
Hmm. Interesting.
You know, I think emerging overall, which has underperformed developed markets for the last 2 years, will start to be an outperforming trade. They were taking back a lot of the lost ground in December, and as we've mentioned at the top of this interview, you know, emerging down small this year with the S&P being up 6%. Hmm. So I think there's more room for that outperformance by emerging to come on back here, and I think it's that's safe if the global backdrop continues to be global growth at 3.4%, not necessarily cranking in all of the developed countries, but there's enough growth in the United States, there's enough growth in China to give the rest of the emerging world, you know, kind of the engine they need to drive their underlying valuations higher.
Yeah, good stuff. All right, Tim Seymour, again, magnificent drummer. And managing partner of Trigem Asset Management. And we'll put all the links to that and, of course, to emergingmoney.com on the show notes for this. And appreciate your time and have a great weekend next week. And look forward to talking to you soon.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks a lot.
Thanks. Bye-bye. All right, right before we got to that great discussion with Tim, I was mentioning a few different things. And I want to talk to you about Trigger Point Research Commodity Alerts, because there's a big change coming and I want you to know about it. First of all, one of the big things about trading commodities, whether it's a future on the S&P 500 or you're trading, I don't know, corn or oil, whatever it is that time is of the essence. More so than when you're dealing with stocks or mutual funds, clearly, or ETFs, because commodities can move. They're a leveraged investment and they can move very quickly. And what we're looking for with the TPR commodity alerts is a condition that sets up that gives you the opportunity to move from a consolidation zone, whether it's on a short-term or long-term time frame, into a fast zone, as we call it. We find these areas through the algorithm that looks for and identifies these zones that happen where a position or an instrument can move very quickly. Now, with current commodity alerts, what we do is we send out a text message and we send out email, just like we do with the TPR equity alerts, and subscribers get that, and they act on it, and we give them the actual stop. We give them the profit target, and you just enter that in your system wherever you're trading, and you're good to go. Now, that's good. That's fast. But the next stage of this, the next development of this, is even better. See, what we're going to do is we're going to actually work with a company called Collective 2, and what we're going to have is the ability to, number one, give you even faster alerts. Number two, if you choose to, you could actually link your brokerage account directly to C2, and it will automatically trade the account for you. Now, what we do is we base it on a $25,000 theoretical account size, and that is a one contract per signal investment. So, for example, if you get a signal that says, go long the S&P 500 E-mini futures, and that goes in the system will automatically trade one contract for you. We'll have the stop order and the profit order in there, and that will change dynamically if appropriate, and it will be set. And then you may get another one, and you may trade, for example, oil, whatever it is, okay? Now, if you have a $50,000 account, you get two signals, or two contracts, I should say, one signal for two contracts. So you're automatically sized correctly in your account. And when you sign up for the commodity alerts now, you'll get both either a text message if you want, or an email, or you'll get a automatic trade directly to your brokerage account. Now, there's some accounts and some brokers that can and cannot do this, but there's a whole list of them that you can, or we'll set you up with one that's very inexpensive to deal with. And then you just go directly with them. But basically, you have the opportunity now to deal with the actual trades and not worry about, am I up during those hours? Can I trade it right then? I may be doing something. I don't want to miss something. What if I don't enter it correctly? Very, very cool. So that's coming out very shortly. And what's also nice about that is you'll get a weekly summary of everything that's happening like you do now, a little bit different, but a weekly summary. You also get the opportunity to look at the past alerts very quickly right on the C2. You have a login. You just go right to Collective 2 and you log in. You see all the trades that are there and the past trades are there, what has happened. And you get a very complete package so that you're very much aware of what's going on at the same time. You can always cut it off whenever you want, but basically this saves you the aggravation of saying, hey, when do I trade this? How do I trade this? I don't know how to trade this. Now, commodity trading is very aggressive and it's very risky, and you have to understand all the things that are involved. This is really only for people that understand a bit about commodity trading and futures trading, because it does have a much different degree of risk than stock trading. And we've also been asked by many people to put the stock alerts in the signal for the same thing, to have it a little bit more automated too, because a lot of people, maybe they're in, for example, another country, or maybe they're working during certain times of the day and they can't act on some of this. So many people have asked us to put the equity trading there as well. Well, we're not doing that exactly right now because, you know, we are just starting with a couple of different strategies here on the commodity side. The first one's going to be basically the commodity alerts as you see it now. And the next stage is going to be an automated trading system based on the algorithm. So you're going to get a lot more trading activity in the account, trading 12 different commodity instruments. So that's something that's coming as well. And that's going to be, you know, more for the more aggressive investor that really wants to leverage their positions. Again, it's about a $25,000 theoretical account minimum so that you don't have any margin problems. And we will trade, depending on the time frame, all the different instruments automatically that we have set up this algorithm and this strategy to actually signal when this is going to happen. So there's kind of a couple different strategies that are happening. If you're interested in that, go to triggerpointresearch.com. You can click on the area for contact us and find out. We'll get you set up. There's a couple of forms on there to contact us. Go right to the contact us and put down all the information. If you're interested, just send it to us and we'll tell you what to do. I thought we'd spend a few minutes talking about China, because China has been a very interesting player right now in the global economy. Now, for a long time, China was the driver of, I guess, the recovery, we could say. Back in 2008, when they put that $500-plus billion stimulus package in to create infrastructure development, to help out not only the average person, but everyone in China. And putting $500 billion into that economy is not like putting $500 billion into the United States economy. And we know that what happened was a massive inflation rise in that country that happened in the 2 years after that. And the government was all over trying to keep that inflation from, you know, getting out of control more than it was already. And, you know, they had a series of rate changes in terms of the reserve requirements for banks. They also looked at cutting down on how much property someone could buy. And there was a whole host of measures that were put in for some time that really tamped down the inflation, but also really played a little bit of havoc with their markets. And all of a sudden, there was a little bit of relief that the government said, you know what, it's time to kind of start thinking about growth again. And they kind of let up on some of those very, very strict measures. And what we saw was a change in the dynamic. And in the summertime this year, or last year, back in 2012, there was kind of a bottoming that was happening. And there was a question, you know, will they be able to get out of this? Or is this another structural situation that's going to plague the global economy? And what we see now is that from the last couple of reports, maybe the last three reports on economic activity in China, things are a bit better. We saw the service index actually continue to climb. That was over the weekend. This weekend, we saw that that number was better than the last several months, and they've been climbing over the last several months. But more importantly, the key manufacturing number, which is very important, was much better. Now, exports still have been suffering. So the question is that all that manufacturing actually going on to provide for the domestic economy? And if the domestic economy is actually doing better, well, then that's a good thing. Their currency has been rising, which is something that was very important to the U.S. because the U.S., of course, wants to have the weakest currency in the world so that we can find buyers for our products. And now we're in a neck-and-neck race with the Japanese, because they have been talking up quite the storm and pushing their yen down. And yen's at about 91 right now. It was 78 only a few months ago. That's a big move for a currency. You're talking about close to 17% move on the yen to the downside. That's amazing. What that does is it creates for us, for example, the ability to buy Japanese goods at about a 15, 16, 17% discount. Well, we like that. That's also good. And that helps out their exporters and helps out all the manufacturing that goes on there. Of course, the opposite is true when it comes to China. But what's really interesting is a lot of questions have been asked, what's going on with the euro? Tipping on 137 last week. We know the underlying economy is not that strong. We know that our economy is a lot stronger. So when we see better results for manufacturing, we should see the dollar move higher against the euro. But really, if you think about what's going on, the big backdrop of all this is very simple. I said it before, I'll just mention it again, that we have Japan and their leaders talking down their currency dramatically. We have the potential for the never-ending quantitative easing program that goes on here in the United States, and that's really equivalent to talking down the currency as well. In Europe, on the other hand, what they're saying is that they want a strong Europe, and they're going to do anything they can to protect the euro and the euro region. They want to keep it all together. So what you have is one government in Europe, the government there, saying, hey, we're going to make sure things stay strong. And in Japan and the United States saying, hey, you know what? We want things weak in terms of our currency, basically. So what are they doing? Currency traders are clearly listening to that and saying, hey, you know what? We're going to sell the yen and we're going to buy the euro in a cross-currency trade. You know, we'll sell the dollar. Where are we going to go? We'll buy the euro. Because if they're saying that, we're just going to play along with what the finance ministers and the government is saying. It's a pretty simple discussion. Does it really have anything to do with the true underlying economics? Somewhat, but not really, because while the yen should have been weaker for a long time, the fundamentals really weren't there underlying in the economy, as a matter of fact. So that wasn't there. But now we should be seeing the dollar rising, but it's not either, because we have this kind of manual suppression of the dollar that is continuing due to the Fed. So kind of that's where you have this whole thing in a nutshell. The question is, how far will the yen go? They're talking about that they would desire to see it at 100 to 110. Well, we're talking about another 10% move to the downside. I mean, that would be equivalent to a devaluation of the yen by about 25% if it gets to that level. Pretty amazing that a currency can move that much without any kind of real underlying change in what's going on, and particularly nothing more than a lot of rhetoric by the government. They really haven't started doing anything yet, and they've also said that they're not going to start doing anything until 2014. So maybe markets are looking a little bit advanced and saying, hey, we don't want to be behind this, so you know what? We're going to kind of start moving out. But it also, you have to realize that oftentimes we do see, very often, an overreaction one way or the other. So this could be just a little bit more of an overreaction right now. And the Japanese markets, if you've looked at them, if you deal with it in dollar terms, you made no money, because the Nikkei has moved up in lockstep with the yen moving down. And if you had the dollar out there, obviously you have 15% gain on the index and 15% loss on the currency equals zero net to you. So it depends on how you invest in it in local currency, or if you invest in it in dollars, depends on what happens. Now, one of the interesting things we've also seen with all this is that gold has been kind of weak. We saw one day up, one day down, but there's clearly some gold sellers out there that, you know, you have to wonder where they're coming from. Is it, we thought in the beginning of the year that it was a kind of a mandatory dump from some of these players that had so much gold and they kind of had to liquidate their portfolios because of such a poor showing overall last year with like a Paulson. Or is this something more? Is it kind of a risk on trade saying that, hey, you know what? We're not as worried about the world situation as much as we were. But yet at the same time, we're seeing that all these countries are really trying their best to devalue their currency. So that doesn't really make sense. We're seeing that many of the food products, the softs, the wheats, the corns, and the soybeans have come down in price. But yet oil, even though we saw inventories rise less than expected last week, hit 97. And we could blame that on, there's some things going on in the Middle East and all that. But the fundamentals do not support where oil is right now by any stretch. That doesn't mean it won't continue high or stay where it is at this point or within a range. But the fundamentals don't actually show us that oil should be at 97. When you have the United States, you know, pumping oil like crazy and really developing their whole structure to extract and build an energy independent country, and you see that the overall use of oil is down, I mean, that is a sign that there's something that is a disconnect between the actual trading and the price and what the underlying value is. That will, mark my words, that will come into proportional reality shortly, and it will be an ugly situation the longer this stays up. The longer we overshoot something, whether it's a market, a commodity, any price overshoot that is not supported by fundamentals can stay for a while. It's just kind of what happens in these markets. You get more people that hop on, and it's kind of a domino effect when you have a situation like this where there's no fundamentals and prices start to move and the trend followers get in there and they just start moving and the shorts get squeezed, they sell, which is the equivalent to a buy. And then what we have is a real mess on our hands, because when that thing spikes to that last point is when usually you see the last rotation happening, last guy in, and then from there, there's no more buying pressure and fundamentals take over. So keep your eye on oil here, you know, in this range within a few dollars to see what happens. We actually initiated a short position last week, I believe it was, maybe a little bit before that. A little bit in the negative side of that, but I think that, you know, when we look at the overall economic environment and that the world growth is kind of slowing, even though we see some areas that are better, the fact is that we may not be slowing down as much, but clearly we see that the U.S. GDP ticked down to a negative 0.1 last week, a big surprise compared to the 1.0 on the positive side that we were supposed to see. And whether that's a transient situation that will be corrected with revisions or whether that is a start of a new trend when we see some negative numbers really popping up here, even though we saw the manufacturing better, is something that you really need to pay attention to right now. Because, again, this overshoot that we're seeing in terms of market valuations and investor euphoria compared to the underlying fundamentals of earnings, even though there are those that say that the markets are kind of cheap, not every stock is cheap. You know, when you look at the markets, you have to kind of extract your financials that give you a kind of a false reading, and things are not as cheap as they may seem. So just consider that. Now, of course, the one caveat to this is that when you look at valuations, you know, the simple PE, you have to realize that there is a normalized and a long-term average of PE. That's one thing. On the other hand, you have when times are good, or when at least investor sentiment is good, they will push PEs up because that is a new pricing model that they were willing to pay more for a stock. During recessions, oftentimes what happens is that you revalue the price of stocks based on PE downward. So if you have an average long term of 15, 16, or 14, whatever the exact average is on that, and you say, okay, well, we're in a time of growth, well, you may push that up to the higher end of that, 16, 17. When you're in a slowdown, you drop it down and you have to reprice stocks because what you're going to see is a lot lower spending and a lot lower earnings and a lot lower revenues. Now, realize already, we know for a fact that we've seen a change to the tax of individuals' paychecks that has yielded a lower paycheck on a regular basis because we saw the payroll tax holiday go away. That's going to lead to less available discretionary income, however you want to slice it, because we know already that while the Fed is telling us that there's no inflation, and okay, we'll believe those numbers, the fact is that everything is costing us all much more on a regular basis than it did just maybe a year ago. And at the same time, rates are not increasing, so you have the whole sector of people who are not investing in stocks, for example, who may be in bonds or in CDs or in some kind of fixed income products that are living on that because that's what they choose to do. That's the right allocation for them. That's the right safety and risk parameter for them. They're not able to spend because rates are so low, and I get calls all the time, Andrew, where are the rates? I'm like, well, you're not going to get anything reasonable. You know, and I recently had somebody call me and said, hey, I got a CD I found for 2% for a year. Isn't that great? Isn't that great? I'm like, well, it's not really so great. I mean, it's great in this environment, but man, that's awful. In 5 years from now, if you take out a 5-year CD, you're going to be miserable about the fact that you had that CD there. We're already seeing that just slightly the 10 and the 30-year is ticking higher. The 10-year breached that 2% level last week. And, you know, we're seeing signs that maybe this bond rally that we saw over the last decade, where we saw bond prices move higher as interest rates continue to move lower, and a lot of it artificially due to the Fed, but some of it due to fear and desire to be in fixed income rather than in stocks, has been incredible. It's done great things for corporate balance sheets because they're able to refinance. And then also that's been great for people who borrow money and companies who borrow money to maybe build or manufacture because they can get it at very low rates and lock in for a long term. But at the same time, there's another side of the coin where the people that are buying the bonds and the people that live on the income, whether they're pension funds, whether they're individuals, these are not generating as much income, which is also the reason, by the way, that we're seeing that there is a desire to move into equities. They're being pushed into equities. You don't have a choice. Where you can have an S&P yield of 3% or so, and you can find stocks out there, whether they're MLPs, whether they're REITs, whether they're utilities that are yielding much higher, much higher. Why not go there? So that's where you're seeing the backdrop of the continuation of a push into markets right now. So keep that in mind when you're looking at the markets and realize that people are being kind of corralled and herded into a certain asset class by the very nature of the environment that we're in, and they're being forced into that, which they may not be too comfortable in. And those that are being forced into that area may be the first to leave when things get a little bit rocky. So just consider that. We're still seeing a lot of bid to the markets. You know, every dip is kind of bought, thinking that things are just going to get better, the Fed's going to stay there forever, et cetera. So that's kind of what's going on in terms of the bigger picture and the bigger kind of dynamic of markets right now. We're also seeing that, you know, Europe is saying that, hey, things are better, although Spain had a negative 1.8% print on their GDP, and that kind of wrecked their market over the last week or so. I think it was down 5% last week. You're seeing some holes in the whole Italy situation come to fore. But at the same time, regulators have said that, you know, hey, the Basel III regulations that were supposed to be implemented by now, hey, we're going to give you some more time. And that's been the play right now. It's kind of like, hey, if you can't meet the deadline, okay, we'll move the deadline. It's a very soft oversight. There's very soft governing going on right now, which, again, is adding to the ability for investors to feel a bit more comfortable, realizing that all these things that are happening, you know, the government's going to be really soft on. They're going to be soft on all the things that happen. Nobody goes bankrupt. You know, nobody goes to jail for bad dealings. It's, you know, everybody's, it's okay. The final product of this, though, is what? It's exactly what we saw many times in the past when government has been very soft and lax on their oversight. Because what it does is it breeds a lot of moral hazards. It breeds a lot of discontent. It breeds a lot of underlying investments that really shouldn't have been put on the market. And already we're seeing that the no-cost mortgage, you know, no nothing down mortgage is coming back. We're seeing the junk bonds and securitization is coming back. This is all part of the pattern that we've seen time and time again, because governance won't do anything when they're in the office to upset anything. They don't want to. They want to stay in office. That's the new, you know, paradigm. Stay in office at all costs rather than do what's right for the people and for, you know, the economy. Markets have been squarely in focus by this generation of Congress and the administration. They're really fixated on this, and it's kind of spread throughout the world. Rather than dealing with underlying problems, they're dealing with the kind of the quick fix to make sure that everybody's happy, creating a wealth effect that kind of can spread. So that's what it is. But how long does that last? I don't think it lasts forever. So with that, I guess my point here is that, you know, kind of keep your antennas up right now for looking for cracks in the baseline and seeing if there is a change in the dynamic. You know, continue with the trend where it's working. Find the companies that are really producing good continual earnings that are, you know, kind of growth oriented in terms of continuing to beat on their own metrics, not just on analysts, but they're growing on a regular basis year after year, where you see profits dipping down 50%, you know, compared to a year ago. Well, maybe that's not something you might want to deal with, even though the stock is moving up on the earnings announcement because they maybe beat a little bit. What's the long-term play with that? I'm not quite sure. You have to be careful about that. All right. I'm going to end on that note, and I got to mention again that you're going to check out Commodity Alerts. Send a contact information piece if you're interested in auto trading, or if at least you're interested in the new type of process that we're working on. We're going to be in the process of converting over all of our clients, all the subscriptions that have the Trigger Point Research commodities to the new system. I think you're going to really like that. and the signals will be available very much quicker. So go over to triggerpointresearch.com and check it out. We'll see you again soon next week. Oh, we're going to have some fun. We'll see what happens with the Super Bowl index or the indicator, if you will. And I'm going to tell you a couple more things probably about what's going on with some of the indicators that we built for TradeStation that you can access. So you'll find that very interesting, I think. Thanks for joining me. See you again soon. Bye-bye.
Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.